morning, everybody. My name is Max Rudman. I'm the chair of the Young Israel Shom Emunah Chesed Committee, and I've been working with Bikur Halim, which is the sponsor, co-sponsor of this program for a number of years. Bikur Halim of Greater Washington and the Chesed Committees of Young Israel Shom Emunah, Camp Mill Synagogue, and Silver Spring Jewish Center are all sponsoring this program. In addition to a variety of services it provides to the ill and their families, Bikur Cholim has sponsored a wide range of educational programs related to health, aging, and many other topics. We typically offer 3 or 4 programs per year. The next one is on February 19th, on how to get the most of your doctor's visit. Today's program is an important program on a sensitive topic, and you'll find out why as we get into it, that we offer to elevate our consciousness of important issues and how we relate to each other. If there is any issue that's important to our community, one of the most significant ones has to do with fertility or the lack thereof. So we'll give you a brief introduction of the speakers, then we're going to get into their presentations. We'll have a lot to cover. We'll have some questions and answers time at the end, and an opportunity to ask our presenters on a number of questions that they're going to be addressing. So a little bit about our speakers. We don't have to say a whole lot about Rabbi David Rosenbaum, the Mar D'Atra. He's been in Silver Spring for over 30 years. He's learned and taught at the Yeshiva Greater Washington, where he received smicha. He's been a rabbinist since 2000, and for the past 11 years at Young Israel Shomer Emunah, where he's now the senior rabbi. Atar Rosenbaum has been teaching for 18 years, the Torah school first, and now for the Yeshiva of Greater Washington Girls Division for a number of years as well. I want to introduce then Esther Silver, who graduated from the Johns Hopkins School of Nursing. She started her career in New York University in pediatrics and decided to switch to women's health. She took a strong interest in fertility and started working in Brooklyn in the Genesis Fertility, which is the largest fertility clinic in Brooklyn. She's been sensitive to the needs of the Orthodox community for a number of years, and she published an article on an issue that's important in fertility, egg freezing, the Journal of Halacha in Contemporary Society. When she moved to Silver Spring with her husband, Binyanim Silver, the assistant rabbi here, she was able to join the Shady Grove Fertility, which is the largest fertility clinic nationwide, in their Washington office. Introduction is Dr. Karen Wasserstein, who graduated from Rutgers University Graduate School of Applied and Professional Psychology, and she's worked with a number of individuals, couples, and groups in the Maryland area since moving here in 1998. Karen works with the general population as a special niche focused on working with individuals and couples with fertility issues. Karen works in Bethesda in a private practice affiliated with the Shady Grove Fertility. So we're very pleased to have people who are very knowledgeable and will speak from their experiences, professional and personal. And I look forward to learning a lot about your own reaction to their presentations. Thank you very much for coming. We'll first start with a presentation by Rabbi Rosenbaum.
Thank you. As Max said, we have a lot to talk about today, but just extremely briefly, on behalf of all of us, I want to give Max a tremendous thank you. He puts in a great amount of effort to these programs time after time, and he keeps on pushing us to try to think of what other meaningful topics we can bring to the community. So a big yashar koach to you. Thank you very much, Max. And of course, thank you to Dr. Wasserstein and Rebbetzin Silver and my wife. I think it'll be a very meaningful program. But just at the beginning, to touch on a few points, why exactly are we here? I think the strongest reason why we're here, and kol hakavod to all of you for coming, it's really a bechina v'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. We need to love our fellow as ourselves, and the only way we can do that is if we understand what people are experiencing. There's no way we can really understand what a person is experiencing. Every person is different, every experience is different. But to try to understand is a very meaningful thing. So in my mind, that's the greatest reason why we're here today. Judaic points that if there was more time we'd be talking about them at great length, but we're not. But just to touch on them, philosophically, why should it be that there's ever a couple who has challenges having a child? Obviously the ways of God are way, way beyond us. But I think as a very basic approach, I think the healthiest way to look at it is God gives us all challenges in this world. We have a thought of the standard path in life. Sometimes it takes people a little bit longer to get to the path that we think of as standard. And sometimes the plan of God is a person will never make it there. And these are the ways of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's way beyond their understanding. But I think it's extremely important to try to move away, certainly when we're looking at someone else as, well, it must be they did something wrong. These are the challenges that God presents in the world, among many others. There are many, many halacha questions about fertility-related issues, certainly fertility treatments, where the medical world is today is tremendous. Thank God the vast majority of shilas about fertility-related issues is how and not if. The vast majority of situations, in my opinion, it's if a person were to embark on a path of treatment or trying to decide about treatment, I would strongly encourage people to get in touch with a halachic authority. I consider myself capable of dealing with such issues. Thank God we have a number of wonderful halachic authorities. I want to welcome Rabbi and Rebbetzin Frank here. But it's very important. There are definitely halachic issues, but thank God most of it is what the appropriate way to do it is. If you incorporate a rabbi from the beginning, it can be extremely productive. So thank you very much, and I also look forward to hearing many meaningful things.
Sarah is 23 years old. She has known since college that she would need to have assistance from fertility specialists in order to have a baby. She has premature ovarian failure, and the only way for her to become pregnant is through the use of a donor egg. She came today with her husband to discuss their options. They know they walk through the store and will emerge on the other side on a potentially very long journey. They hope to agree on a donor that they will both be comfortable with to connect with the doctors, the nurses, and the entire team at the fertility center. These are really the new additions to their family. Sarah and Abe will be spending most of her non-work time over the next several months with them. Sarah will see them more times than she will see her parents, her best friend Laura, and even the cashier at the supermarket, whom she sees almost every day. These people will know intimate details of her life, will be inside her privacy in a way that almost no one is. She and Abe are ready for this, they think.
Penina doesn't know if she can do it. She made the appointment, but as she parks, she is not sure she can put one foot in front of the other. Infertile, she says to herself. I'm infertile? Maybe if she says it enough, she will believe it. Her mother never had trouble getting pregnant. Her sister did not have trouble getting pregnant. Actually, for the past 3 years, it seems that no one has had trouble getting pregnant. Sometimes it seems like everyone is actually pregnant at the same time. Facebook post and Facebook post, it's confirmed. She is the only one not having a baby. Her husband simply says, get off of Facebook. But does that really make it better? Just because I can't see it, doesn't make it not real? She tells him, maybe that's the same with this idea that I am infertile. Just because I can't see it doesn't mean it's not real. I need it to be real without consuming all of me. She realizes she takes a few steps and she goes into the building.
Rachel knows that sitting in the fertility clinic can be especially difficult for her. She can relate to the other women sitting there, yet she is so different. After some waiting, she was blessed to give birth to a baby boy, Joseph, and he's amazing. But she and Jacob wanted more children, a house full of children. They love each other so much and have so much love to give over to their family. But she has recently been told that they have secondary infertility, meaning fertility problems after having a successful live birth. Sometimes this happens, they've been told, with a lot of other information, but that's all that they were able to hear. And the advice that they've been given from friends and family, be happy with what you have. Don't be greedy. Joseph is so lucky to have all of your attention, and he makes you so happy. So sitting here in this waiting room with these issues, other women, she knows that she is different. She assumes they would say, be grateful. If only I could have just one. If only I could become a mother. They must just think I'm crazy. They will think that Joseph is enough. But is he? Or rather, is that even the question? Our desire to have more children is not a comment on Joseph. Is my struggle not also a struggle for me and Jacob to go through together without feeling judged? Where can we find understanding?
I couldn't even stay there. The doctor kept talking, but I'll admit I left in the middle of the appointment. I never dreamed the problem was with me. I have infertility issues. I'm a man. I would never have expected that. We started trying a year ago, and then my wife went in for a fertility workup. They insisted that I have a workup too. The problem is with me. How do I watch my wife as she watches other kids play at shul, when she is the only one at a Shabbos table not getting up to check on the kids? Who supports me? But I guess I can't ask that question when I haven't told anyone the truth. Let's face it, I've barely told myself the truth. Now we have an appointment tomorrow with the specialist, and I know I will meet doctors and nurses, and they will all know, and they will all discuss it like it's no big deal. Maybe that will help me make peace with it. Maybe not. His wife. Rivka is 31. Soon by you, everyone said when she was 21 at her brother's wedding. Soon by you, they said, when her best friend Esther got engaged. And then it was her. She and Isaac have been married for 3 years now. Then came the next phase, the babies. Soon by you, everyone said, at her niece's Simchat Bat. Soon by you, everyone said, when she and Isaac were the kvatzers at Esther's son's bris. But it's been 3 years since they got married, and they just found out that Isaac is infertile. People no longer say, soon by you. And it now feels like they walk on eggshells around them. No one knows they have just received the official diagnosis. They live alone even when they are in a crowd. They have just been given the news that the best way to proceed is to go through in vitro fertilization. This means shots, hormones, monitoring, being subsumed in this every day. She has staff poking and prodding her, asking the most invasive questions. They're so nice, but she doesn't feel she can even talk to her husband about this. How can she talk to anyone? She is so alone. Soon by you can't come soon enough. Yes, to become a mother, but also just to feel like herself again. One of the many, to take everything for granted. We want to first talk about a few of the statistics and a few of the kind of guidelines of who we're talking about. When we talk about infertility, it really encompasses a lot of different people. We're talking about those who have trouble getting pregnant, and in the medical world, that's usually defined as someone who has trouble getting pregnant after a year of trying, but depending on the woman's age, treatment can start earlier. Those who have had recurrent miscarriages, and those who have genetic issues, such as Tay-Sachs, that lead them to use fertility treatments as a means of having a healthy child. Fecundity is defined as the ability to get pregnant and carry a baby to term, resulting in a live birth. And as we mentioned in the vignettes, one of the things we really want to highlight today as well is secondary infertility, which is often overlooked, so you'll hear us point it out time and again, which is defined as the inability to have a child, another child, following a live birth. And one of the things that I think is really important, because it kind of goes against all of our cultural stereotypes that's been told to us over and over from basically the beginning of time, infertility affects men and women equally. It's not often the woman's problem or often the men's problem. It's pretty much evenly based. And 25% of infertile couples have more than one factor that contributes to their infertility.
Okay, so how many people are we talking about that are actually going through infertility? So according to the CDC, the most important thing I thought to bring up from here, that there's about 7.5 million women between the ages of 15 to 44 that are going through some kind of fertility issue. In a normal cycle, the chances of, in a normal natural pregnancy, the chances of achieving pregnancy per month is about 10 to 15%. Now, this is a cumulative statistic. So between the ages of 20 to 29, over a year of trying, there's about an 85% of achieving a pregnancy. Between the ages of 30 to 34, that drops slightly to about 75%. And that tends to decline with age, which is one of the reasons for secondary infertility. Just mainly with age, the chances of conceiving drop. That's a whole other topic. We're not going to get into that today. But what I'm trying to say is, that as well with age, the miscarriage rates increase as well. So there's about a 15% chance of infertility between the ages of 20 to 29, and a little bit higher between the ages of 30 to 34, and that tends to get a little bit higher after that age. Okay, so taking the first step. So a lot of questions that people have is, when is the right time that they should go ahead and see a fertility specialist? That's actually one of the first questions that I get when I get personal phone calls from people is, like, when is the right time for me to go ahead and start to see a doctor? Just coming up with that question alone has mean that, that means a couple's been really grappling with this to come to the point that they actually have to think of going to see a specialist. And for some reason, when it comes to a fertility doctor, people want to go to anybody but the fertility doctor. They'll run to their OBGYN, they'll run to their friend that's a doctor to maybe prescribe the most first-line common drugs of fertility, such as Clomid and Letrozole, but they don't want to go to the fertility specialist's office. You know, and to that I say, with any problem in life, if you have an electric problem, you're not going to call your plumber, and if you have a plumbing problem, you won't go to your electrician. You're going to go to the specialist that's going to give you the most help in that area that you need. So walking into that office is scary because, first of all, it means admitting that, yes, there may be a problem. On the other hand, walking into that office could mean it's just a small glitch in the process of you getting pregnant, and it could just be a small blockage that's in the way, and then you'll get pregnant right away. But it could also mean that you're going to have to discover that it's going to be a journey. So there's a lot of fear to be walking into that office. You know, there was a couple that I was meeting with after a follow-up visit. So this wasn't the first visit to the doctor. And they were sitting with me grappling when was the right time for them to start their treatment. They wanted to figure out a month where they were going to be not as stressful as they usually are. And then they were calculating the 9-month delivery date that they would have if they started this month. And they wanted it to be a time when they would have a lot of support from their family and, you know, things would be at a good time in their life. And they're grappling with months and delivery dates until finally they turned to me and they're like, do you have any advice? And to that I turned to them and I said, you don't know when this journey is going to end for you. You don't know how long it's going to take. All you need to know is that you're ready to start. That's the only decision that you can make. Not to let time go by, but that you're ready to start. The rest of this is not going to be in your control. So common reactions that I get to this, grief. I have couples that are upset that they're not going to be able to have a baby the normal way, even if they are going to be able to have a baby. There is denial, couples that walk in just to gather information, but they're completely disassociated from the process, which is also fine. If that's your process, that's your process. There is a lot of couples now, once they are diagnosed with something, it could be any type of diagnosis in the broad range of fertility, this becomes the complete focus of their life. They are now identified as this. So every single thing that they're doing in life is consumed by the idea of being identified as going through fertility. So this is the patient where I walk into my office in the morning and I'm getting emails from my patient. They've been up at 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m. They're going through Google. They're searching through the internet, looking for alternatives, questioning their treatment, trying to find other answers, looking for outside sources. Should they try acupuncture? Should they change their diet? Should they sleep more? Should they stress less? All these different things. Anything that they can do to change this. They're focused on this all the time. Completely understandable and one of the normal responses. For many women in life, a fertility diagnosis is as stressful as a cancer diagnosis. It's the most traumatic event that's occurred for them in their life. And so their stress levels are so high that every single thing in life, just regular life, is going to increase their stress levels, such as sitting in traffic, a normal stressful environment, to a patient going through this, that increases multiple folds. So the hardest part, I would say, about all of this is that they're really stressed, and yet to the rest of the world, nobody's going to know what's going on in their life. And they're going to have to hide that stress. So let me give you an idea of what it means for a person to jump into this new world of fertility. it's really interesting that we have all of this medical technology. We can take an ultrasound and literally probe into any organ and see exactly what it looks like, yet we have no control over being able to get somebody pregnant, even though there's lots of hopeful control and lots of very positive outcomes we experience. But for this patient, their life is now going to be centered daily with the nurse and the doctor that's treating them for their fertility. That person's going to become intimately involved in their life, knowing very intimate details, which to our patients it's very hard to become that intimate, but for us, it's as common as talking about the weather. We're sensitive to it, but we're very comfortable with it. The other thing I would say is that once a person is actually stepping into fertility and working on being treated, the nice part about it is that you become part of this secret club that you never wanted to be part of, but once you're in it, there's a lot of support there. The process of just pre-screening alone is just doing all the testing and all the workup that we can do. Our focus then is removing any obstacles that we think could be causing the fertility or the infertility. So during that process alone, it's very stressful because the entire time you're waiting to get answers in a very time-sensitive way that could change the outcome and can give you hope or no hope. So just the workup alone is very difficult for patients. There's many different types of treatments for fertility. Some of them are very quick. It could just mean a quick outpatient procedure. It could just mean taking an oral medication and you're moving on. For some people, it's going to be a longer process. It's going to be coming into your doctor's office and finding out that you're going to be going home all alone at night or in the morning, and you are going to be giving yourself injections or with your partner. Everything is going to be extremely time sensitive here. So for some people, for the more invasive treatments, it's going to be 10 to 15 days of coming home and giving yourself injections nightly and in the morning. Some of them are going to be subcutaneous that are going to be skin deep, and some of them are going to be intramuscular into the muscle. This is going to mean that you are committing to coming into our office every single morning during those 10 to 15 days or more for some people, having blood work done and an ultrasound done in a waiting room with multiple women during a small hourly time frame, about 2 or 3 hours at a time, and having blood work drawn and having ultrasounds done. You are then going to be running off to work, and that patient's going to have to explain to everybody why she was late that morning. And all the stress along that she's been going through, and then waiting for a phone call in the afternoon with the results of everything that she had done that morning to give her instructions to follow through that night, which is going to be specific instructions tailor-made to her very response that morning. And she's going to have to grab that phone call wherever she is, on the train, on the bus, at work, finding a corner that's going to be private to talk about the most private thing going on in her life to make sure she understands everything for the following night so that she can come back and be tested again in the morning. The side effects of what a person could be going through is multiple things during fertility treatment, but for the more invasive treatments, we're going to be taking an ovary, which is normally the size of a walnut, and with the hormones, that ovary is going to be growing to the size of maybe a tangerine or a small orange. And so that patient's hormonal levels are now going to be highly increased, making, you know, she's not feeling that great, basically. So the other part of it is the actual outpatient procedure that patient may require. She'll probably get about 2 days' notice because the doctors are going to look at her ultrasound that morning and decide that now she's ready to have a certain procedure. And she's going to have to change her work schedule around to make sure that she can be at that doctor's office for that procedure that's going to be under anesthesia when we decide that she needs to have it, with at least about 2 days' notice. So I actually once had a Hasidic patient that she would be sitting in the waiting room every morning and she'd be sewing a gartel. And I remember every morning we'd see, she'd come in and she'd say hi to us and we'd see how her gartel was getting longer and longer. And during every single IVF cycle, she would be starting a new gartel. So I remember that patient also called us up one time and she was like, she called the after hours emergency line. She said she was at home with her husband. And I always found her very interesting for ways that she would deal with her stress. And she said they were sitting at home and they were just laughing so hard, she's afraid she pushed out her embryos. So I told her that she was absolutely fine. She actually got pregnant that cycle. But, I mean, this is obviously everything that happens when you're going through this process, you're always afraid that you're going to have done something that would have changed things, especially because you're at home a lot with these injections and you just don't know whether you're doing everything the right way. Because everything is so time sensitive, patients may come across scenarios that they may have to work out, such as getting blood drawn on Shabbos. So they may, I know that in Brooklyn, they may have to encounter, there's a non-Jew that comes to draw people's blood on Shabbos and go and deliver it to their fertility clinic for them. People may encounter scenarios where they have to question having injections, somebody come to give them injections on Shabbos or having to give the injections on Shabbos or Yentiv. I know that Bonei Olam and Atayim are able to put people up in Manhattan if they have to have a procedure done on Shabbos or Yentiv, and they'll organize things for them and have meals. Not saying that this is what everybody does or that it's okay. These are just scenarios that can come up for people. I also had a friend that had to go to multiple centers because each fertility center has different strengths and weaknesses and different labs have different strengths and weaknesses. So she may have started treatment somewhere else and then had to continue her treatment in another center altogether. So there's a lot of things that these patients are struggling with and trying to balance. So what is the cost of all of this, all of these different procedures? It's a lot. So a small procedure could be starting at around $1,000, and it can go all the way up to $50,000 for just one procedure. I did find in New York that more of the insurance companies did cover more procedures. I found here that it tends to be a little bit less, but some insurances cover completely. I don't see that so often, but some of them cover partially, and sometimes patients are finding ways to pay this money out of pocket. We did provide resources for different Jewish organizations and things like that that are there to help patients with money for this treatment. Medications for fertility treatment. Medications have to come from fertility pharmacies. You're not going to be able to pick up these drugs just from regular pharmacies most of the time. They are all specialized drugs. Fertility drugs can range anywhere from one cycle costing about $3,000 to around $8,000. Again, depending on the treatment, sometimes it is less if it's a less invasive treatment. I'm just giving you the range of things. And then there's the best part of my job. The best part of my job. So one of the things that I love giving over my job is the pregnancy outcomes. I do get to call my patients with that, but getting to that point is a really, really long waiting game. When a patient or a person is trying naturally, it's a waiting game. When you've put all this money and all this effort and changed your life around to make this possible, that waiting game is really, really long. So giving over the pregnancy outcomes is actually, believe it or not, more of like a roller coaster, because I can give over three different results. I can give negative, positive, and you can actually be a little bit pregnant. What does that mean? You can get results that could be a biochemical, it could be a really low number, it could be a possible ectopic pregnancy, or it could just be an abnormal pregnancy. So that means that even though the patient got somewhere, she now has to go on this roller coaster ride to see where her pregnancy result is going to end up. So yes, I give over many, many, many positive results, but you know, it is difficult when you get that in-between number, and it is really difficult for patients to have a negative result. I don't have to explain that. I just wanted to highlight two scenarios of patients where I just saw a lot of strength when I had to call them up with results. I had a patient that had gone through multiple cycles, and IVF cycles, actually, and I had to call her up with her results, and I gave her the negative outcome, and do you know what her response was right away? Baruch Hashem. I was speechless. I didn't know what to say. I had another patient that was not Jewish, and I called her up also to give her a negative result. And she said, you know what? My clock is not God's clock. My time is not God's time. And when it's the right time, it'll be the right time. And it was actually quite humbling when recently my practice celebrated their 25th anniversary, and Dr. Levy, he's the medical director of the clinic, he is a non-practicing Jew, And he was talking about how he deals with what he does, a special practice he does after he transfers an embryo. And an embryo is a fertilized egg, was fertilized outside of the lab, became an embryo, and at the blastocyst stage, when it's become multiple cells, we transfer it back. And he said, immediately after the completion of the transfer, I close my eyes and breathe out while silently saying a prayer, the Shema. For me, this is an acknowledgement of my insignificance in the process of creating life, that the unknown is so much greater, and when I exhale, it may be that I am a fortunate vehicle, that my actions and my breath could help stimulate the life that we have transferred.
I want to pick up on some of the things that Esty talked about and expand them just a little bit. We're going to talk about some of the same things, but in a little bit of a different way. Can you just press start? I want to talk a little bit more about these issues of grief and loss. And in a fertility scenario, issues of grief and loss are often very compounded. They layer over each other, and they're often very cyclical. So every single month someone doesn't get pregnant, they often feel that again. Every time they go through a cycle of IVF or some fertility cycle, they feel that again. And these scars are kind of part of you, or become a permanent reminder to you for a long, long time. So what is the loss, right? Because this is a different kind of loss than a death of a person. But these are a loss of control. Very often when we grow up, we're told, you know, work hard, you can achieve. You know, you set your mind to it, you can do anything. And all of a sudden, you really can't do everything. You may want, you may work, you may desire, and you may not get what you've been working towards. The loss of an experience, the loss of becoming pregnant naturally, the loss sometimes certain procedures use a surrogate, or people end up adopting a child, which is a beautiful scenario as well, but then they also feel this loss of being pregnant, giving birth, and the physical process. The loss of privacy and control of your body, as Esty talked about, it's really a lot of people involved in very private aspects of your life. And the loss of an imagined self, an imagined picture. When you're little, you draw this picture of what your life is going to be. And then when you're dating, you draw this picture together of the family you're going to create and the life you're going to create and the scenario. And that picture sometimes gets shattered into a million pieces. And you're not sure if it's going to get redrawn the way you envisioned, if it's going to get redrawn in a different way, and what that's going to be. And those are all things that really trigger this grief and loss process. We talk about the narcissistic wound, a wound to the very center of yourself, and redefining who you are. This grief is kind of, we talk about it as disenfranchised grief. It has kind of nowhere to go. This lost relationship, this loss isn't talked about. It's very invisible. It's socially unrecognized. The community doesn't know about it, or they do and they don't understand it, or they don't know what to do with it, and we're going to touch back on that a little bit later. A couple, very often, even though they're going through it together, they're not going through it in the same way, because as much as you're together, you're two individuals. And sometimes that actually is a very hard idea for a couple going through it together when they don't go through it exactly the same way. And at this very sensitive stage, it does seem like everyone else is getting pregnant. Your siblings, your neighbors, your friends. And again, talking about that secondary infertility, if you have a toddler in preschool and everyone else is wearing that big brother, big sister crown when they have a new baby, you are not, and you're aware that your kid isn't going through that experience as well. So I talk to my patients a lot about this idea of your own self-identity. And I talk about it as a word cloud, right, which is what this picture is. And very often you see a word cloud after the president speaks, right, State of the Union, and he talks about taxes a lot, so taxes is really big, and he talks about terrorism a lot, so terrorism is really big, and he talks about the Montgomery County bag tax, just a teeny tiny bit, so that's really tiny small. So it's proportional. And we all have our own word clouds of what our identities are. So I'm a daughter, right? And that's a piece of me that will always be a piece of me. But I guess when I was 10 and I was living at home with my parents every day, that was probably a bigger piece of me. It took a larger step. And today, it's always a piece of me, but it's gotten proportionally a little bit smaller unless something is going on, and things change situationally as to how big that is. When someone has an experience that they need to integrate into themselves, it very often crowds everything else out, but it almost has to in order for it to become a part of yourself. If you heard in one of the vignettes, we talked about someone just repeating over and over this, and I was like, I am infertile, and for that to become a part of your self-concept, it almost crowds everything else out. Same thing if I have cancer or I've become an orphan or any of these big new definitions. And the task is to integrate it within yourself and as a part of yourself without it taking over the rest of your identity. So you may be infertile or have infertility issues, whichever way you want to phrase it. But you're also still a daughter, a sister, a husband, a spouse, an artist, a lawyer, whatever else you are, and it becomes a part of you, and it has to, without superseding everything else about you. And that is one of the tasks that we take really seriously. I talked a little bit about a couple who come at this from a different perspective, and so I want to talk about some of the stereotypes, but these are research-based, but they're still stereotypes because they clearly don't fit every single person. So women, culturally, as we know, historically, infertility has been seen as a woman's issue, and I think even today, childbearing is seen as very central to a woman's identity, including the process of pregnancy, birth, and nursing. So women often, not always, they report more stress, anxiety, and depressive symptoms. They're often more willing to share their feelings, look for support, either through counseling or social support, and they are often more hesitant to accept the end of treatment. And that's something that couples really do have to come together on. Are we doing one more cycle? Are we continuing this? Are we looking at other options? And when two people don't hit that point at the same time, that can be very challenging that we work on. Men, the flip. Men often have particular distress when male factor infertility happens, a diminished sense of masculinity, more avoidant coping mechanisms, denial, distancing, and withdrawal. They're less likely to utilize outside supports, less sharing of feelings, and more into problem solving than focusing on what the experience is. I'm sure you're all shocked by the stereotypes. I can see it on your faces, but I promise it is research-based and not just anecdotal. Okay, so when we talk about a couple, I love this quote. The task for a couple. Each partner needs to regulate his or her own emotional distress, tend to the emotional needs of the partner, be sensitive to the needs of the relationship, and consider the practical demands of the relationship. Well, that sounds really easy, right? I mean, like, that's nothing. All right. Whoop. This computer is extremely sensitive. All right. So what do we have here? This is the proverbial, yes, we need stadium seating. It is an elephant in the room. So when you come into my therapist's office, What do you think could be some elephants in the room that a couple is afraid to say out loud? I'll take any ideas. Does anyone have any thoughts? Yeah?
Blaming the other person.
It's his fault. It's her fault, and I can't say that out loud. What kind of person would I be if I really said that out loud, right? All right, what else? That can't be. Go ahead.
In the Torah observant world, at a certain point, Is my
what is this going to look like? Religiously, dynamically between us, I'm afraid. I'm afraid for our future on every level possible, right? Anything else? Go ahead.
A lot of people don't want to share their grief, their anger, their denial. It just doesn't get said, and everybody kind of sits down with them.
Okay, so everyone's kind of walking into this room with a wound that is open. And they are just afraid of brushing up against anything because anything is going to make them just beyond sensitive and push that wound into absolute pain. Yeah?
I think also specifically in the case of secondary infertility, you know, we did it before, why can't I do it again?
Right.
Frustration.
I understand. How can this be such, I've conquered this mountain. I should be pregnant again. I know I can do it, or I know he or she can do it, or I know we can do it. What? I'm just at a complete loss. Okay? Anything else? Yeah, Max? Oh, you're just worried about time. All right, last one.
Right?
Why? Why? Where is God? Where am I in this whole picture? All right, so I'm going to give you some of the common ones that I hear a lot. All of the ones you've said are also, they just didn't all make it onto the slide. Because of me, he or she doesn't get to have children. And I can't say that to my spouse. I don't know how to say that. I'm having religious issues, and I don't know how to say that to my spouse. I've heard this one. If I didn't marry him, or if I didn't marry her, I'd be a parent already. Right? And that's really important. You look at that, especially with the people with genetic issues, that's true. My in-laws will blame me. How do we tell anyone? Right? I don't even know how to walk into their house anymore. I can't tell him what I think, or I can't tell her what I think, because then she'll think, or he'll think I blame him, and I'm so alone, and the other person in this relationship is just not enough. This is the last one, Max, I promise. So what are the goals when I'm looking at a couple or individuals, but mostly a couple? To help the couple manage the stress of treatment, improve the communication patterns, and ensure that there is support for one another, identify the coping styles and see how they add or detract from the relationship. And I really think this is very important. Different coping styles isn't better or worse. It just means they're not the same. So it is okay for each person to cope their own way. Discussing differences in utilization of support systems. Who are we going to tell? You want to tell? I don't want to tell. How do we navigate that together? Changing problematic coping styles and preparing for the end of treatment and building that future together. The next section we want to talk about is that each person, I talked a little bit about living within a couple, but each person lives in these interlayers of our world. There's the individual, as you should add a layer for the couple, the family, the community and the culture, which is what we're going to talk about now, and the society as a whole.
Okay, so let's see what we're faced with, being the odd one out. Yentiv, Shabbos, Brises, Shalom Zachar, your friend's Kiddush, your siblings, your friends, everyone else is having their second or their third child. It's hard for a person going through this not to be envious. People may need to stop attending simchas or weddings. It's too hard for them. Don't question that. It's hard for everyone that's going through this, whether they look like it's hard or not. So my advice to you, and this is advice that I've acquired from talking to counselors, grief counselors, counselors at Bnei Olam and Atayim, nurses, support staff in our practice. Don't approach anyone with advice. Don't approach them at all, unless it's obvious that you've undergone infertility. The most that you can say is, if you have any questions, just come and ask me. Don't get more involved than that. For mothers, mother-in-laws, and parents, you don't know whether you should get involved or not. Don't. Don't get involved. Unless you feel that your children are going through financial troubles, the most that you can say is, if you need any money, just come and ask me. And if you have the money, just give it. Don't question, give the money, don't ask for anything else. People have this need to know where their money is going, and you don't have any idea how many children are calling Bnei Olam and Atayim lifelines to get financial support because they don't want their parents meddling in their privacy. So again, if you have the money, give it. And to parents also, I just want to say that by giving that money, if you have it, and whatever it is, anything helps, just remember that these are your grandchildren that you're helping to produce. Just keep that perspective. Everybody kind of wants to help somebody that they think that is going through infertility and they want to try to give them some advice. The bottom line is there's a lot of information out there. There's a lot of support. Again, we have a list of support services. People can get their support. They can get their advice. There are rabbis. There's all different ways of getting advice now. They can get it. Don't worry about it. So if you have a friend or a family member that you know is struggling for fertility and you are having children and you are pregnant, how can you deal with that scenario? And to that I would like to tell you, don't wait for her to find out from someone else. Take that person into your confidence and tell them before anybody else finds out. It's going to hurt them no matter what you say. That pain is not going to go away. And don't apologize for being pregnant. Take her into your confidence and act natural. Act like you would tell anybody else. And it's going to hurt, but that's the best thing that you can do. There's a story of one of my friends that she was pregnant and she knew her best friend was really struggling with fertility, and she avoided telling her. She didn't know how to handle the situation until she was showing and it was obvious. And then she went over to her and she told her, and she said, "You didn't think I knew the entire time." That's the worst way for the person to find out. Tell them ahead of time. And remember, your baby is not taking away their baby. Your baby is not taking away that person's baby. Just be sensitive to what they're going through. And on that note, I'm going to be handing it over to Rabbi and Mrs. Rosenbaum.
No, me.
Oh, sorry. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. I'm so sorry. I will hand it over to you just 2 minutes.
Time. All right. You're not taking away our time. It's
excellent.
Time.
Okay. All right, that's okay. The last thing we really wanted to talk about, and then we have a teeny tiny video, we are handing it off to you. But the last thing I wanted to talk about were supports within the Orthodox community and how we handle it. Esty touched on some of this. I want to touch on some separate aspects of it. I talk to my patients a lot about secrecy versus privacy. And secrecy is something that you're afraid of. There is an element of shame sometimes. Privacy, as I tell my clients and my children, is privacy is something we need to claim. It's our privacy. We can claim it. We can tell who we want. And you darn well better claim your privacy in 2016 or it doesn't exist. Everyone thinks that everything is public all the time and you're hiding something if you don't tell it. But if you frame it in your own mind as this is private to me, it really changes that dynamic tremendously. We're going to talk about, the video will help talk about how to be supportive of others, but we wanted to talk about just, I am there for you, I'm just checking of you, on you, I'm thinking of you, instead of being invasive and getting inside of other people's privacy. And the last thing we really wanted to talk about was how, you know, we've talked before, earlier in the presentation, about these ideas of grief and loss, and then how do we as a community approach that? It's often very, very invisible. And we don't have a script for it. So even if we know about it, we don't have a script for it. And we are a very script-oriented people, right? When someone dies, we all know exactly what to do. This one does the mirrors, and this one does that, and then we get food. And we really revolve around scripts. We have scripts for almost everything, exactly how to do it. I don't know if anyone has seen, there's a video going on around about this comedian who's talking about, like, thankfully, we don't celebrate Christmas, because if we did, there would be so many rules, exactly how to put up lights in your house and how to chop down your tree and all that. It's part of who we are and how we handle things. So when we don't have a script for things, we're at even a greater loss, I think, of to know what to do than people who don't normally work that way. And it sometimes makes us retreat even further from people because we don't know how to be at a loss of a process of how to deal with it. And I think that's something we have to be really sensitive to. Are we taking a few steps away? Are we distancing ourselves from people in a way that we don't really need to because we don't know how to handle it? So with that, we're gonna flip to this because I... All right, so we think this will be very helpful. You're gonna have to excuse us as it insists that we watch a slight ad, but we're going to click on that as quickly as we can. And sometimes it doesn't make us watch an ad. Let's see. Oh, it doesn't. Excellent.
Okay.
I can't hear it.
I turned off.
Did you turn off the...
Pause it.
There is a microphone. Did you turn it on?
Turn it on.
So what is empathy?
Perfect.
And why is it very different than sympathy? Empathy fuels connection. Sympathy drives disconnection. Empathy, it's very interesting. Teresa Wiseman is a nursing scholar who studied professions, very diverse professions, where empathy is relevant, and came up with four qualities of empathy. Perspective taking, the ability to take the perspective of another person, or recognize their perspective as their truth. Staying out of judgment, not easy when you enjoy it as much as most of us do. Recognizing emotion in other people and then communicating that. Empathy is feeling with people. And to me, I always think that empathy is this kind of sacred space where someone's kind of in a deep hole and they shout out from the bottom and they say, I'm stuck, it's dark, I'm overwhelmed. And then we lovingly say, hey, calm down. I know what it's like down here. And you're not alone. Sympathy is, ooh, it's bad, huh? No. You want a sandwich? Empathy is a choice, and it's a vulnerable choice, because in order to connect with you, I have to connect with something in myself that knows that feeling. Rarely, if ever, does an empathic response begin with at least. I have it, yeah. And we do it all the time, because you know what? Someone just shared something with us that's incredibly painful, and we're trying to silver lining it. I don't think that's a verb, but I'm using it as one. We're trying to put the silver lining around it. So, I had a miscarriage. At least you know you can get pregnant. I think my marriage is falling apart. At least you have a marriage. John's getting kicked out of school. At least Sarah is an A student. But one of the things we do sometimes in the face of very difficult conversations is we try to make things better. If I share something with you that's very difficult, I'd rather you say, I don't even know what to say right now, I'm just so glad you told me. Because the truth is, rarely can a response make something better. What makes something better is connection.
Now we'd like to pass it over to the Roosevelts. If I can figure out.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So we were asked to share our perspectives from our own experience, and really we would like to begin just by apologizing if, heaven forbid, we offend anyone, whether anyone present, whether anyone listening. Every, as has been said already, every experience is really very different, and we don't mean for a moment to say that this is how it works. This is just one experience that we're sharing. If I could give three specific disclaimers as to why our perspective is, I think, uniquely unique. The first is, in nature, we really are both very private people. We're not the type to wear our emotions on our sleeves, and therefore it could very well be that the amount of support that would be helpful for other people might not be as relevant in certain ways in our circumstance. Second way is we are extremely blessed. We have extremely broad and vibrant and very connected lives to so many wonderful people. We're so connected to people, thank God. We're socially connected to so many people. So many times you hear accounts about people who felt like the world was passing them by because they didn't have children. We were very connected to people's simchas and people's experiences because of our professional situation. The third is my wife happens to be a tzaddikas. That's the third. So for that combination, our
first... That was not written down.
That was not written down. That wasn't on the... Do you do marriage counseling also? Just to give a very brief personal profile for those who don't know us, we were married pretty young. We were married at the age of 21. We've been very fortunate to be married for 18 years. Our first child came 11 years into our marriage. Today, we are extremely blessed with four children, Kanai and Hara, ages 7 to 2.
First of all, I just want to say, Karen and Esty, that was just amazing. I don't really know why I need to talk after that, honestly, but just that was really amazing. Okay, but here's just my personal experiences. Again, as my husband said, this is not what everybody necessarily goes through. I remember the moment in high school when it occurred to me that we weren't all going to have the exact lives we were expecting. I was honest enough with myself to realize that I might very well be one of the people who didn't find a shidduch or have children or find employment so easily. That said, I have 5 siblings, so my expectations remained that I would also have a large family. I was used to a lot of activity in a home. I couldn't even imagine what it would be like to live with only 2 people in a house, at least until I met my husband. As the years went on and the prospect of having any children at all seemed to grow smaller, I had to face certain other fears and disappointments. I am the grandchild of Holocaust survivors on my father's side, and the thought of not having the opportunity to contribute to my family's continued growth and survival was certainly painful at times. We don't truly deserve anything we have in life, and having children is not part of every person's mission in life. But it did occur to me that I personally might need to earn my right to have children. I could not say that I had earned that right, and I was able to accept this. What was difficult when I followed this train of thought was the idea that my lack of merit might result in my husband not having children either. I often davened to have children for my husband's sake, even if I couldn't have children in my own merit. Finally, though, I really, really love children. I enjoy them whether or not they are mine. This made it easier in many ways. I had relationships with my nieces and nephews, with my students, and with the children in the shul. But I understood children well enough to know that there is something a parent gives a child that no aunt or teacher or rebbetzin can give them. I did want to be able to give that to a child, to be that person for a child.
I also enjoyed our connections with our Kanainahara numerous nieces and nephews very much. And as we would interface with those nieces and nephews, I had this niggling question in the back of my mind, which is, God willing, when we get older, are these the people who will depend on to take care of us? But what pressed me, what stressed me much more, was a more abstract idea. If after 120 years, when my wife and I would leave this world, would we leave anything behind? Would we be able to have another generation? Or would it just end?
When you have young children, your life is inherently meaningful. You are one of the people they completely rely upon. Without children, I felt a strong pressure to somehow justify my life to myself, to others, and to the Ribono Shel Olam. I am by nature, as my husband said, a very positive person. Like most people, I prefer to be happy and content with life. I don't want to paint a picture of someone who was always positive. I certainly had my moments. There are one or two particularly painful episodes that stand out. During one such period, I remember working on the computer at home when I heard music coming from the other room. My husband was listening to a CD. It was actually probably a tape cassette at the time. A song suddenly came on. Olatz libi b'Hashem, Rama karni b'Hashem. From Chana Hanavi's Song of Praise after having her son Shmuel Hanavi. I was very familiar with the words. I taught them almost every year in my Sefer Shmuel class. But at that moment, the words hit me differently, and all I could think of was how sure I was that I would never get to praise Hashem in that way. To my poor husband's shock and dismay, I ran into the room and blindly shut off the tape with tears streaming down my face. So I certainly had my moments of real pain, but they were by no means the norm. In general, it was actually very difficult for me to put so much focus on what I did not have, instead of focusing on all of the wonderful things I did have in my life. At the same time, as Esty mentioned, fertility treatments take up a tremendous amount of time and energy. They require you to spend so much of yourself on the children you don't and may never have. I found this so difficult, in fact, that I was firmly resolved that I would never do any more treatments after having even one child. In terms of my relationship with others, certainly one of the most difficult challenges of infertility was the thought of others looking at me with pity. In fact, I had to overcome this discomfort in shul when parshios dealing with infertility were read. I stand during Torah reading, and during the Yomim Noraim especially, it was difficult to keep my focus on the krios and haftoros, and not on how others might feel I was feeling.
For me, personally, one of the most challenging aspects was, where are we going with all of this? As I frequently said to my wife, if Eliyahu HaNavi would have come to us and said, you know, you're not supposed to have children, I could have dealt with it. We would have been missing something, but as I said, we had a lot going on in our lives. It was so challenging to continue. Again, much more for my wife than for me. My wife had to go through so much physically and scheduling, etc. But just the very idea, we're trying another time, we're trying another cycle. Obviously in tefillos and prayers and things of that sort. So are we going towards something, or is it all going to be that it's just not going to work? Obviously, it was important for me to be, I don't know if I'm supposed to be empathetic or sympathetic, but to the numerous things my wife was going through, my wife individually was going through. But there was yet another challenge. There was one time my wife turned to me and said, you know, I've never seen you cry about this. Is this bothering you in the same way that it's bothering me? It's not my nature, similar to my wife, it's not my nature to show that things are upsetting. But that was also something I had to work on, expressing myself in that way. Every now and then, whether it be myself, whether it be my wife, whether it be the two of us together, we found ourselves engaged in a uniquely challenging situation, and it was clear what the right thing to do was, but it was equally clear that that was very challenging. And whenever those would come up, I think many times you had in the back of our minds, you know, this is going to be the moment. This is the schus, this is the merit, we'll do this, and then things will change. And you know what? It happened so many times, and to the best of our knowledge, nothing was changing. We definitely had financial burdens in the sum total of our treatments and medications. Our insurance covered a very small percentage of the sum total, and we had thousands and thousands of dollars to pay out of pocket. Being at Life Cycle Simchas, I wouldn't say I was jealous of people. Personally, I just found myself becoming more and more emotionally detached. Happy for the people, happy to be there, but just sort of beginning to ask myself more and more, will we ever do this? Will we ever celebrate a child's birth? Will we ever celebrate a bar or bas mitzvah?
For me personally, I appreciated it when people did not spend all of a conversation talking about their children. Parent-teacher conferences accepted, of course. At the same time, I did not want to feel that the topic of children was being avoided at all costs. A difficult balance, I know, but that is how I felt. I also wanted to be treated as someone who has something substantial to contribute to my community and my family. I really appreciated when others made me feel that I was significant and accomplishing a lot.
I just wanted people to treat me normally. I didn't want sympathetic conversations. I didn't want to have to confront what we were going with unless it was a time that I wanted to. So I appreciated people's concern as a demonstration of concern, but I didn't want to talk about things unless I would initiate the conversation.
Certainly, the thing that made it easiest during that time period were the basics in Emunah that we had gotten from our parents and our teachers. I remember sometimes sitting in a fertility clinic and thinking that, wow, this is so much harder for everybody else in here. Because here I was saying to Hillel, I had something very specific to do with my time, and all they had to do was cross their fingers and hope that this was going to work. And in addition, that if it didn't work, where do they go from there? And to me, it was, well, if it didn't work, that isn't what God wanted. I have to say that all of my friends and family did such an amazing job of insulating us from insensitive topics of conversation. They made us a part of their lives and their children's lives without making us feel that we had no life without children. My in-laws would write me the most beautiful birthday and anniversary cards about what a wonderful wife I was for their son and how they thought of me as a real daughter. I'm sure that surprises those of you who know my mother-in-law. My father-in-law would always be taking pictures of the two of us to put up in the house. Our nieces and nephews would treat us with excitement and respect. They never made us feel like the Nebuch aunt and uncle. At the same time, I was very aware of how distressing our situation was for our family, not as objects of pity, but because they cared so much for us. When we found out we were expecting, we wanted to tell them as soon as possible in order to spare them every additional moment of heartache. I told one of my sisters I was expecting while she was still in the hospital after giving birth. She told me that only now could she completely enjoy her baby. This will probably sound strange to some of you, but I also found great comfort in my interest in Jewish history. I read a lot of biographies, and many, many leaders of Klal Yisrael struggled with infertility. I was inspired by the lives of great couples of the previous generations, such as the Chazon Ish and his wife, or Meir Shapiro and his wife, among many others, who left everlasting legacies and generations of students, but who did not have biological children. Lastly, I personally knew so many people who were going through or had gone through similar situations. Even if I didn't discuss it much with them, I never felt alone.
I gained a tremendous amount of strength and support from my wife. As I've said, we're very private people. We didn't want to share the specifics of our issues with different individuals. To this day, there's an extremely small number of people besides myself and wife who know what our fertility challenges were. And all of those people are people who could help us in some concrete way. Friends, our family, we've never shared it. And in many ways, I feel emotionally, my wife and I, by our own choosing, were on somewhat of an island. I think over this period, our marriage became all the stronger and all the more meaningful. I also want to mention how fortunate I am and was to have a Rebbe that I could discuss these things with. It was very important. It's funny, when I was preparing for this, I asked myself, how many times did I talk about related matters with my Rebbe? And the answer was very, very few. But the point was, when I wanted to, he was always there for me. It was someone that I could trust, that we could trust. If I wanted perspective, he could give me perspective. If I wanted support, he could give me support. But that relationship was extremely important for me. And I want to specifically mention both my parents and my in-laws. To the best of my recollection, not once did they press us for any information. Not once. And the only word I can say about it is I find it completely remarkable. And certainly in any way that they could be of help, they were always available to us in any way, shape, or form. But it was completely on our terms.
I was very rarely offended or hurt by remarks people said during this time. I can't say what particular things were inappropriate to say. It had more to do with people's attitudes. As I said, I was particularly sensitive to the thought of others looking at me with pity. Baruch Hashem, we have been fortunate to live in such a wonderful, sincere community. If someone expressed concern for us and it felt insincere, then it was offensive. But if it was sincere, I always took it as it was meant.
I also was not offended per se by things that people said. I saw it came from a good place. I do want to share one specific experience. I think it shows, at least in my case, sort of what was on a lower layer, my emotions. I was once hurrying into a mincha minyan, and a young fellow from the shul paused, stopped me. He asked, "Do you have the time for a quick shaila?" I said, "Sure." So he said, "You know, my wife is expecting, and we're trying to figure out if we can buy a stroller now." Now, I'm a rabbi. He's a congregant. I had been asked questions like this, and afterwards I was asked questions like this, and it's fine that he asked me that question. For some reason, and to this day, I can't tell you why, for some reason it hit a nerve for me. And and that was the only time such a question hit a nerve for me. And I answered him in a very, very terse way. I apologized to him later for it, but I happened to be running into Mincha, but I didn't want to deal with him at the time. As a postscript, I want to mention, I think that mincha was the most inspired tefillah I ever davened in my period looking for children. So Just interesting to think about the way things work.
It did not take hindsight to appreciate our years without children. Even at the time, I remember thinking that I had a remarkable opportunity to try things and accomplish things that I could never have done with children. Whether it was at work, in the community, or even with my own family, there were things I could do then that I certainly can't at this point in my life. I was able to give shiurim and have study groups on a regular basis. I juggled jobs in multiple schools. I was able to be very involved in extracurricular activities where I taught. I was able to push and challenge myself, and therefore develop into a much better person. I am also so grateful in retrospect for the perspective to fully appreciate each one of my children when he or she was born. I think that if I had started off my married life having children right away, I would always have been looking forward to the next child and possibly disappointed when another child didn't come along as quickly as I wanted, if at all. Our years of infertility allowed me to be overjoyed and overflowing with gratitude to the Ribbono Shel Olam for each child. Most importantly, though, our years without children were a special time for our marriage and relationship. We learned to navigate hardship and disappointment together. We learned to rely upon one another. This can and does happen with children, but we had the luxury of being able to entirely focus on each other and building our partnership.
I firmly believe I'm a much better father today. I'm sure I've got a ways to go, but I believe I'm a much better father today because of this experience. I think I look at my children with much more appreciation. We have a practice in our family marking each one of our children's birthdays. For each one, my wife and I do something special, some spiritually oriented thing, as a way of showing our gratitude to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, not just for having children, but for having this specific child. I don't think we'd do that if we hadn't have had this experience. I do want to mention one small thing that we do. My wife mentioned the song before that I was playing, and it was a painful song for her to hear, and she turned it off. So as many of you know, our oldest child was born on Purim. So every year at the Purim Suda, we sing that song, that very song from Shir HaShchanah. Rare is the Yom Tov Kiddush, which involves the bracha of Shehecheyanu, where we thank God for giving us life and bringing us to this day. Rare is the Yom Tov Kiddush that when it's time to recite that bracha, among the blessed chaos of our table, that I don't glance over to my wife and we just exchange a look for a moment, that we thank God for bringing us to this day. If I can just, in closing, slide my rabbi hat back on for a very brief moment. Quite appropriately, we've discussed today very meaningfully ways to help people, ways to stand back. I want to share one story that my wife reminded me of, which was, we didn't remember if it was after our Yosef was born or after when she was obviously expecting Yosef. An individual in the community came up to my wife, not someone we're particularly close with, and said, you know, my wife and I have had the practice over these last number of years that when we would be in the labor delivery room, when one of our children was being born, we would be saying Tehillim, and at some point we would dedicate the recital of Tehillim to the rose of moms having a child. Maybe that's why we have children. Who knows? And I know so many in this community, I normally keep my cool. I'm the guy who's not in touch with emotions, right? That's what I told you. I know so many in this community. We know so many in this community have davened for us for so many years. Might have been our tzvilos, might have been your tzvilos, might have been our mitzvos, might have been your mitzvos. Who knows? But to just remember that, it's the greatest thing we can do for someone. They don't have to know that you're davening for them. The power of tefillah, we're celebrating the first day of Hanukkah today. If we believe in God, and we believe in miracles, and we have people that we care about, we have to daven for them. Thank you very much.
you very much. We have some time for some questions. We had some very interesting presentations, very moving. Time for you, if you have questions. Or if you'd like, I can pass around some cards and we can go that way as well. Mitch?
In general, out of bricks, for example, the metal can give profit to people who don't culture. Is that appropriate? Should we keep it to people who are recently married? Is it insulting for people who've been married longer and not had children? And how many times would you guys get a profit?
Should we keep in mind that you were clather at one of our children's breasts?
And you were clather at my son's breast
also. Oh, that's right. I don't know. I think we might have different perspectives on this. I personally really liked being asked. I know other people really don't like being asked, and they're embarrassed by it. I personally was never embarrassed. I was always very, it made me feel good that someone was thinking about me. Everybody's different. I think it's the type of thing, like Esther was saying before, where you just have to tell the person and it might be painful. I think it's the type of thing where, again, as long as you're being sincere in asking them that, and you could say, totally fine if you don't want to do it. I mean, there were situations where we didn't do it, just it was difficult for us to do it, but not so much emotionally, but for other reasons. And just, like, not to put pressure on the person, I think, is a very big deal. I think some people, I mean, again, I can't really say for people in general, but for us, at least, I think, I don't know how you felt.
I think I was also touched by the offer. I was touched by the offer. I didn't like when you made me wear the Redskins paraphernalia, but I was touched. I was touched by the offer. Sometimes I wanted to do it more than others. I'm not doing it with the people, but just what was going on in our lives and this and that. But I would agree with what Tara said. I would.
Another question?
Go ahead.
First of all, just thank you very, very much, all of you. It's been just very moving and very amazing. I have a question about the sympathy issue, since I have people who I dearly, dearly care about who have gone through these issues. And I have, thank God, the blessing of having six children. And they're many times these very wonderful people, they will not tell me, or they'll just be extremely emotional and almost angry. You don't know what this is like. You have no idea. You haven't been through this. I will say I've been through other difficult situations and other challenges. I do try to be an empathetic, but it's very hard because there, a person is sobbing uncontrollably with facing these challenges. I don't know what to say because almost anything I say is, you don't understand, you don't know.
I think I would say that. I would say
that. Can you formulate a question?
I form it as a question?
Yeah.
Sorry, it was a monologue.
I don't know. Oh, you want me to repeat it as a question? So I think if I can summarize it, but tell me if this is right, what you're asking is when someone is coming to you very emotionally and everything you're saying seems to hit wrong,
yeah.
No matter what you're saying, you're trying so hard to just be there, but even every, you know, and tapping into one of the things in the video was, you know, trying to tap into something of a similar feeling,
right,
to be able to connect. And I think that, I still didn't make it a question, but what do you do? Okay, I'll put a question mark at the end of that. I think you start where you ended off, right? When someone says to you, you just don't get it, I would embrace that. I probably don't. I'm just going to sit here with you. Is it okay if I just sit here with you? And know that my not saying anything doesn't, you know, I just want to be here with you, if that's okay with you. Yeah,
follow up. Kind of modify that, and anybody else who wants to share, use any input I can get. The other part of it is people who I care deeply about will not share with me because they assume she'll have no empathy, no sympathy, and maybe that's just something I can't do anything about.
What would you say, Joanna?
I'd say it's someone you can't do anything about. It's pain. I know it's so painful. To be the one
all
who cares
I want to do
about the person.
Okay, or whatever,
yeah.
You know.
Just.
The males,
yeah.
Too, you know. Just
have to
that, yeah. You can always say, I don't have the same experience. I'm always here if you ever want to talk. If you ever want me just to be.
Right.
If you ever want me just to listen. You know.
Yeah. I promise I won't speak. I can always be here for you. If you just need someone who's here for you that may or may not get it. Did you want to add?
No, I want to validate what you guys shared. I really like the idea of going back to resonating within yourself something that was painful for you, and like just feeling that with the person, and that brings out your sincerity in your words when you share them. And just letting them know, I don't want to ask you any questions, and this is your thing, but I am really here for you every step of the way. Just reassuring that, and letting them know if they do have questions or need help, that you want to be there for them in any way that you can.
I think I want to say one more thing. I think when you resonate when something resonates within you, what it's resonating at are those very base core emotions. So you don't have to have always the same experience, but you can resonate with that of, it sounds like I just, you know, I can hear how painful this is for you. And if you can hear how painful it is for them, it's resonating with, you know, the idea or the feeling of pain within you from other previous experiences. It doesn't have to be, well, I once also had that. It's not about sharing the experience. It's about sharing humanity. And as human beings, we all have different base emotions that get triggered at different times. And you know this from what regular loss, when you lose a parent, when you lose someone else. Someone comes in and they say, well, I also lost my parent. Sometimes that helps and sometimes it doesn't. But I can hear how painful this is for you. I think it makes that connection on a deeper way.
I just want to add, I think a lot of us have this need to, when somebody shares something, we want to give them the right answer, and we want to fix their problem, and we're just trying to really steer you away from that solution-oriented fixing. We're just really steering you more towards resonating with that feeling and just showing sincerity towards the person. So just try to avoid that blockage that sometimes happens. Yeah.
Any more questions?
First of all, thank you, Rabbi Robinson, for sharing a very incredible experience, and to the wonderful presenters, thank you as well. Just to sort of further tie together, hopefully I'm helping anyone on the spot here, but as far as if that would be sort of the Rabbi Robinson story, sort of a case study or example of what to do well, so to speak, I'm curious to know from the presenter's experience, and from hearing what Rabbi Robinson shared, what are some of the best practices that they heard from the Rabbi Robinson's stories that you've seen in other scenarios, perhaps, that would be helpful for us to think about?
Go ahead, Esty.
can we repeat that? So can you just like summarize the question? Like, what would be...
Yep, no question. I mean, Rabbi Robinson shared some helpful practices as far as whether it's having to heal him, in addition to certain things that people can say or not say. You both shared beforehand about that as well, some practices, or recommendations that you have. I'm just curious, in that specific story, if there were things that resonated with you that jumped out that can be learned, generalized to the rest of the population.
I can touch on some of it without dissecting the Rosenbaum story, which feels a tiny bit uncomfortable.
Listen, we're messed up. I mean, that's the bottom line, you know.
I heard them say that things changed over time. Sometimes something would strike as very painful when the exact same thing didn't strike in the same way at other times. And there's no way someone else would have known that. So as someone who approached them, you have to understand that you may be rubbing against a wound, an open wound, in a way that you don't even realize it, and just to be sensitive to that idea. I heard them talk about how much support they got from people, from their family and their friends and their rav, who just by being there, not necessarily always saying, so how's it going, how was the appointment, what's going on for you, what turned out, and not having to be a constant news source for those who cared for them, that they had a very understanding social support network, and their own working it out as a couple, and the roller coaster that is, that they were very willing to be on that roller coaster together and understand that each of them were in different places at different times. I think that's the other thing that I really heard.
More questions?
I think Esty just wanted to.
I'll just add on to what Karen said. I have found that most of my patients really want their friends and support network not to look at them as the infertility person. they really want to be a person. And so everyone, like, they're always looking at their stomach wherever they go, and whenever something comes out about fertility, they feel like everyone's eyes are on them, because, like, they must be going through this struggle. And they really appreciate it when they can feel like a person again. And so being that for that person is actually a lot. And being able to balance, and not all of us can do that, but being able to balance sharing that, finding a place where they're feeling and supportive, but not only seeing them as an infertile person, but as all the other things they bring to the world, is tremendous for a person.
Thank you very much for coming, but there is more. There is a resource list. You can continue this conversation with and support your friends, your family members, if you would like to share that, something that both Esty and Karen compiled. You can contact any one of our speakers after this. They've been gracious to offer contact information. So this is something that is going on in all our lives, and I think it's a way for us to see that we can support each other through the information that you heard today. I will also try to upload it and provide it for you who want to listen to it again. And this resource list is available, and I'll try to also make that available. But you can get a copy right now when you leave the room. So thank you very much for all of you. We all look forward to seeing you at another program we're going to have, hopefully, on February 19th. Look forward to your ideas as well. This is a program that is open to what you think is useful to us. I'd like to acknowledge a lot of people have been contributing to this program, those who are not even sitting here. Rabbi Rosenbaum and Dr. Sia Heller have been partners in crime and coming up with ideas over the last several years, and I want to acknowledge that many of the people who are presenting here are a result of their efforts. So thank you very much for coming, and to be continued. Thank you very much.
Thank you.